This is the MyHeart.net podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Philip Johnson in conjunction with VitalEngine.com. Please welcome your host, Dr. Alain Bouchard, a cardiology specialist of Birmingham, Alabama, at St. Vincent's Medical Center, part of Ascension.
Welcome to MyHeart.net, and today we have a very special guest, my very good friend, Dr. Ibrahim Hanna, and we're going to talk about guarding your heart, a practical guide to prevent AFib. I mean, who knew? I mean, most people know that they have AFib. Obviously, there's not a cure. So, you know, even more important to try to prevent it. So here we are today. And we're going to talk about, discuss all the ways, you know, to try to really describe some of the healthy lifestyle that we need to adopt, you know, to prevent AFib. Because AFib is very common. It's the number one arrhythmia. I mean, currently there may be 6 million people in the U.S. with AFib. It's predicted that in 6 years, 2030, there'll be 12 million. That's 1 in 4 American. And to be honest with you, Ibrahim, I don't want to be part of the statistics. I want to prevent it. So maybe we could talk together, because very few people know that we can't prevent AFib. And there's so many, you know, kind of high, you know, healthy lifestyle, you know, modification that we can do and prevent AFib from happening in the first place. So, Ibrahim, first of all, you know, thank you very much for, you know, being here today. Thank you for taking the time. I know time is precious. You know, I think we can kind of learn a lot today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Alain. I am honored to be here. As you rightfully said, of course, we've known each other for a long time, and, you know, we've worked together fairly closely over the years. And you have seen firsthand with your very busy practice over decades that AFib is a big problem. It's a big problem in primary care offices. It's a big problem for cardiologists. It's a problem for, sleep medicine folks. It's, of course, a big part of what I do, you know, being an EP physician. AFib is the most common arrhythmia in the United States and around the world. It is projected to increase. The increase is in big part because of the risks that that we're accumulating in the U.S. population, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's first start by defining AFib. And, you know, sometimes going back to basics is really where one needs to start. It's very easy for us to talk about AFib in very technical terms. The definitions are easy when you speak, you know, the medical language. But if we are trying to explain it to patients, it gets a bit more complicated. So I'm going to try to break it down a little bit and hopefully make it a bit more accessible. So generally speaking, AFib is a very fast and a very disorganized electrical short circuit that starts in the upper chambers of the heart, called the atrium. That's why it's called atrial fibrillation, because the problem starts in the upper chambers in the atria. So that fast and disorganized electrical activity makes its way down to the bottom chambers of the heart, called the ventricles. And as you know, but maybe our patients don't know, the ventricles are the main part of the heart that pump blood all around to all the organs. And so as a result of the fast and irregular heartbeat from the top chambers, the bottom chambers, the ventricles, go also fast and irregular. And so if a patient were to palpate their pulse when they're in AFib, they will feel it to be fast and erratic. That's kind of sort of the general pattern of the disease. So it's primarily an electrical problem. It's a very chaotic and disorganized electrical problem that drives the heart in a very fast and disorganized manner, which is detrimental. The diagnosis of AFib is quite simple to make, you know, for us in our practice. You know, it's either made through an EKG, so you get 10 patches on your skin, you get hooked up to a little machine, takes about 5 minutes, and then the machine will show the electrical activity of the heart. And with an expert eye, you can very easily diagnose AFib. As you also well know, technology is evolving quite fast, and now patients are wearing watches. They have access to the Cardia mobile app and other types of devices, you know, the Fitbit device. And so through these devices, there are also alerts where patients are being told that they have AFib. Now, this may not be sufficient for us to be certain that the patients have AFib, but it's a good screening tool. And sometimes, you know, these devices have the ability to record rhythm strips. And, you know, the patients save them on their phones. And sometimes they come to clinic and they show us on their phones what they've recorded. And that's sometimes sufficient to at least you know, show us a pattern that could be compatible with AFib and engage us in a fact-finding mission, if you will, where we give them monitors or do EKGs and what have you and confirm the disease. So the disease is fairly straightforward with the current technology to confirm. And so it's important for patients to be aware that this is not something that is that requires big intervention for us to diagnose. It's readily available and we're able to do it.
So tell me, Ibrahim, why is it important to keep, to be in a normal heartbeat? I mean, what's the problem with AFib? And, you know, why do we do better in a normal sinus rhythm?
Great question, Alain. Of course, you know, we all know that we are designed to beat in a fairly regular manner. You know, our hearts are designed to beat between 50 and 100 beats per minute when we are at rest. The heartbeat is supposed to be regular to optimize the ability of the heart to pump the blood around in an efficient manner. So when the heartbeat becomes fast and irregular, then it creates inefficiencies for the heart. And in practical terms, what that means is that you are at risk for developing congestive heart failure because the heartbeat is irregular. There's also an increased risk for patients to have strokes. In fact, AFib is responsible for about 1 in 5 ischemic strokes. Patients who have AFib are at increased risk of developing dementia, so have cognitive impairment. And AFib can lead to death. And these are not small increments. So it's not a 10% increase in your chance of dying or a 5% increase in risk of stroke. We're talking about multiple fold increase in these risks. So for example, a patient with AFib is 5 times more likely to have a stroke than somebody who does not have AFib. That's as an example. So also on the quality of life level, you know, AFib can lead to symptoms similar to depression. I mean, people who have AFib feel bad enough that they get depressed. And so it has multiple implications. And so that's why it's important for us to recognize the problem and try to at least mitigate some of the consequences, serious consequences of the arrhythmia.
Very good. So obviously, nobody wants to be an AFib. And let's see, you know, what we can do to actually prevent it. We're going to talk about healthy, you know, lifestyle habits. And the more of these, you know, healthy lifestyle, the better, you know, we do from the point of view of the cardiac standpoint, I mean, as well as to prevent AFib. So let's see if we could talk about some of these points, Ibrahim. We're going to talk about maybe the weight and targeting obesity and an overweight problem. We'll talk about physical activity and how much exercise is good for us. We don't want to be we don't want to be inactive, but on the other side, we don't want to be, you know, doing too much that we can trigger AFib. We'll talk about alcohol. We'll talk about smoking habit, controlling diabetes, and finally, managing hypertension and sleep apnea. So let's start from the beginning. I mean, we want to prevent AFib. Let's talk about the weight and how we can manage our weight. And what does the weight have to do with AFib?
So Alain, that these are all very important questions when we talk about prevention. I just want to just mention first to our patients that some of the factors that lead to AFib are what we call non-modifiable risk factors. So there are things you can do and things you cannot do, okay? And so, you know, AFib is a disease that is more manifest in older folks. Unfortunately, to this date, none of us in the medical field have figured out how to reverse that. So these are, you know, getting older is something you cannot change. And so AFib is a higher risk factor in patients, you know, who are over the age of 60, and then it even gets higher over the age of 70 and even higher again, you know, at the age of 80. In fact, 1/3 of octogenarians have atrial fibrillation. Your genetics are also important, right? So if you are born to a family where AFib was present in your parents, your mother, your father, even if it happened at a later age for them, you are still at increased risk of developing atrial fibrillation. These things you cannot change. So what we want to do is focus on the things you can change. These are the modifiable risk factors. And as you rightfully said, obesity is a significant risk factor for atrial fibrillation. In fact, there is a linear relationship between BMI and AFib risk, such that for each point increase in BMI, there is about a 5% increase in the risk of developing atrial fibrillation. So it's a strong correlation. The reason why obesity leads to atrial fibrillation is quite complex. You know, it's an interplay of hemodynamic changes, hormonal changes. It's the interaction between obesity and diabetes and sleep apnea. But nonetheless, it's important for our patients to know that a rise in their BMI is going to lead to a higher risk of atrial fibrillation. And so it is important to try to control one's weight. And if one is overweight or obese, it is important to try to reverse that, because it has been shown that reversing obesity leads to a decrease in the risk of atrial fibrillation. So in other words, if you have, through you know, factors you can't control or for genetic reasons or whatever it is, you know, your weight has gone up, you can reverse your risk of AFib by working on reducing your weight. So it's not an irreversible process, right? And not only is controlling obesity important in preventing the first episode of AFib, it is also important in reducing the chances of developing AFib once you've been diagnosed with the disease. So if somebody comes to our office and we diagnose them with atrial fibrillation, we are going to look at their weight and we're going to have a very frank discussion, which are, you know, difficult conversations to have in all honesty. But we're going to try to talk to the patient about the importance of looking at all the parameters that will help them reduce their weight so as to decrease the chances of them, you know, having another episode of AFib. And we will talk some more about this when, you know, on the next podcast, if you know, when that happens, when we discuss the ways we can control the rhythm. And obesity is going to be something that patients can control, hopefully, that will help them improve the chances of them staying in rhythm once AFib has happened.
That's really kind of a big factor, literally. Do you want to just kind of like, with the weight, we see a lot of patients with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and it's such an important factor to control, you know, your diabetes and make sure that, you know, that your diabetes is, you know, with the lowest A1C as possible and as well controlled as possible. What's the association of diabetes with AFib, Ibrahim?
It is also a strong independent relationship. And the good news about type 2 diabetes, Alain, is that now the therapies are incredible. I mean, there are so many new classes of agents that not only help with diabetes, but also help with cardiovascular health in general. And we are actually awaiting solid data to show us that these new classes of medications are actually not only going to control diabetes, but they're also going to improve the chances of people, you know, staying in rhythm and not developing atrial fibrillation. Unfortunately, the data is not available yet on these new classes of drugs. But as you rightfully said, generally speaking, bringing your sugar under control, getting to the target HbA1c you should be at, will help significantly reduce the chances of developing atrial fibrillation. That has panned out in, you know, multiple epidemiologic studies. And so we encourage our patients who have diabetes to control their sugar, and some of it will be through, you know, controlling weight, right? I mean, you know, yeah. If you do one, you sometimes also find yourself achieving the other as well.
Exactly right. I think we did an article and a podcast with Tim Garvey at UAB, really showing that, you know, medication like SGLT2 inhibitors, for example, like empagliflozin and you know, the Jardiance and the Farxiga, not only kind of decrease cardiac mortality, but they reduce the risk of heart failure. Right. They improve kidney function. And in addition, we have the GLP-1 or GLP-1 right. receptor agonists that are just life-saving. Right. I mean, they decrease cardiac mortality, the risk of heart attack and stroke. And we can see how, you know, they could be so helpful in management of diabetes as well as in patients that have coronary disease and AFib. What about, so we discussed the weight, we discussed the diabetes. Let's talk about the exercise, because exercise, it's very, you know, kind of a very important component in trying to reduce weight and control your diabetes. Is how much exercise do we need to do to prevent AFib?
So, you know, generally speaking, we tell patients to follow the American Heart Association guidelines. So I think exercising 3 times a week and doing 30 minutes of cardio is quite helpful. You know, we have to be very careful with AFib because there are extremes with exercise, right? And so we have found that patients who are high-level athletes, especially endurance runners, you know, cyclists, they are at higher risk of developing AFib than patients who are exercising with moderation. And so we are not, you know, big advocates for, you know, running, you know, marathons and you know, doing big endurance races because of that increased risk. Now, of course, we're not trying to discourage people from doing it, but they just need to be aware that, you know, pushing exercise to an extreme may actually increase the risk of developing AFib. But exercise is a big part of cardiac health in general. Like, exercise in moderation is very, very important. As you said, you know, it reduces the risk of atrial fibrillation through multiple things, including, you know, controlling weight and decrease the chance of developing type 2 diabetes and others. So it's important to do it in moderation. We have seen, you know, athletes who are at extreme levels of performance who come in and have AFib, and these patients tend to be very, very symptomatic. And so we just, you know, need to be careful with that and not, you know, be pushing it to an extreme.
In general, we do, you know, recommend 5 days a week, you know, 30 minutes aerobic exercise, a little bit of strength training. It really goes a long way. But, you know, we have the very well-known data on, of course, it's in the South, it's not such a problem, but we have like cross-country skiers, you know, particularly in the northern countries, you know, where we see competitive, I mean, these athletes that are competing in the Olympics, and they do have more AFib. Or here, we're in the South, we have triathletes, you know, that are long distance, endurance, you know, athletes that really push themselves a lot for like 9-10 hours. I mean, we're talking about a lot of, you know, extreme, you know, physical activity that can really trigger AFib. What about hypertension? You know, how important is it to control or to watch your blood pressure if we want to prevent AFib, right?
So hypertension is probably the most common risk factor for atrial fibrillation, just because the prevalence of hypertension is so high. It may not be the most powerful, you know, factor, but it definitely is the most prevalent one. And again, you know, hypertension can lead to cardiac remodeling, which means, you know, the heart gets thicker. As a result of that, the pressure in the heart can get higher. And as the pressure gets higher, the atria stretch and develop scarring, and that leads to atrial fibrillation. So it's very important to take your medications as prescribed. You know, we want to target a good blood pressure control. And, you know, depending on your profile, you know, it could be less than 140 over 90, or it could be less than 130 over 80. So, you know, it's important to kind of adhere to your physician's recommendation for blood pressure control. There are a lot of medications that can achieve that goal. You know, there've been a lot of controversy in the EP literature about, you know, which medication may be better at serving both controlling hypertension and reducing AFib risk. I don't think we really need to nitpick. It's just important to control blood pressure and follow, you know, the guidelines. And, you know, we do see patients in our office, unfortunately, who are prescribed all the right medications, but don't take them. And so it's very important to comply. You know, hypertension is a silent killer. So patients don't know when their blood pressure is high. And unless you take your medicine, you can think you're doing great, but your blood pressure could be running really, really high. And that also factors into how we deal with anticoagulation. You know, we're always worried that patients come in with hypertensive crises. You know, so if you have baseline diagnosis of high blood pressure, you don't take your medicines, your blood pressure can shoot up very high, and you're taking a blood thinner for AFib, for example. They were always worried about this becoming a bleeding event in the brain. So it has multiple implications. But as you rightfully said, it's definitely one of the most prevalent risk factors for atrial fibrillation that we need to tackle in our clinics.
Interesting data on mineralocorticoid type of medication, spironolactone and then eplerenone, you know, having some kind of effect on cardiac remodeling and maybe some benefit in preventing AFib. Let's talk about the sins of smoking, you know, and alcohol. Let's talk about smoking first. I mean, we know smoking is bad for your heart, and now it's connected to AFib.
Yeah, absolutely. It is connected to AFib. It is connected to AFib either directly through particulate matter, you know, that you inhale, but it also leads to COPD, and we all have seen, you know, patients who have advanced COPD who come in and have AFib. I tell my patients, you know, the heart is essentially hugged by the lungs. So if the lungs are in bad shape, you know, the heart's going to be in bad shape. And one of the ways it manifests itself is through atrial fibrillation. And unfortunately, once you get into COPD, advanced COPD, and you have AFib, the treatment strategies become very, very limited for us to be able to help with the arrhythmia. And so by all means, you know, avoid tobacco for a variety of reasons, but surely for AFib. You know, that only leads to a path of disease that, you know, is irreversible. Unfortunately, you know, we have no good ways to reverse COPD. As I said before, you know, you can reverse the effects of obesity, but you can't reverse COPD. There is really no good treatment to change the disease process. And when we talk about tobacco, we have to also remember that, you know, it's not just smoking tobacco products, it's also smoking marijuana. There've been a lot of controversy about, you know, whether marijuana has any impact on cardiac rhythms. I think the consensus more and more is that, you know, it does have an impact, and, you know, it may not be as significant as, you know, illicit drugs such as cocaine or even stimulants like methamphetamine, which are significantly more likely to cause cardiac arrhythmias. But nonetheless, smoking marijuana is also a problem. And so, you know, just keep that in mind. You know, unfortunately, you know, you and I are sitting, you know, doing this podcast and telling people not to have any fun at all. But, you know, especially on a Saturday night, but it is what it is. You know, I tend to think about all of these things and you know, find that when I talk to my patients, you have to explain to them. I mean, I try to explain to them the significance of all of these things, but I try not to be a Debbie Downer. You know, ultimately, you know, we don't want to sound so drastic that patients, you know, don't come back and see us, you know, and say, oh, you know, I want to come back and listen to the same, you know, story, you know, over and over again. They're not letting me have any fun. So, again, little amounts, every so often, recreational, if you will, you know, on occasions, is all right. But, you know, like the one pack a day, the half pack a day for 40 years, 50 years, it's just, you know, it just doesn't almost never lead to anything good. So
now, Ibrahim, you know, you and I have some French blood in us.
Yes.
We like our wine.
Yes.
And, you know, we know that there's a linear correlation between the amount of wine or alcohol we drink and the incidence of AFib. So is there kind of a, you know, what is the right advice?
What's the right amount?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know,
Is there a right amount?
Yeah. You know, look, I mean, you know, it's probably easier for you guys in the coronary world because you have a cop-out. You can tell them, you know, you can have a glass of red wine every so often and it's all okay. Fortunately, in the EP literature, there really hasn't been overall, you know, any evidence that, you know, even in moderation, it's okay or even protective. You know, the data is not super clean, but it's definitely clearly linear, except maybe in women where there may be some sweet spot. I don't know, but it's, you know, but just generally speaking, you know, we tend to look at alcohol as, you know, every drop counts against you. I mean, for AFib, right? I mean, that's how we think about it. Again, you know, we have to be realistic. I mean, you know, you go out, you have a party, you know, you want to have a drink. You know, that's fine, but don't do it every day. Don't do it every night. Don't binge. You know, binge drinking is as bad as drinking every day. You know, usually, and people sometimes don't make the association because, you know, it's been shown that AFib after binge drinking doesn't happen the same night. It happens after 2 days. You pay the price later. And so sometimes people have AFib 2 days after they've had like a big party and then they don't think that, you know, the alcohol had anything to do with it, but it does. It's just a delayed effect. So yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, alcohol is not a good thing, but just to be realistic and you know, be frank with our patients, you know, we do it as physicians, you know, we drink from time to time, just, you know, leisurely with our friends when we go out. That's fine. You know, one glass here and there, it's not gonna, you know, be a big deal, but not every night, not routine, not binge drinking.
Yeah. Well, let's cap it up with sleep apnea. You know, sleep apnea where, you know, patients, you know, may have daytime hypersomnolence. They may stop breathing at night. They may snore a lot. Every time I want to send, you know, a patient that has these symptoms, I say, doc, you're going to send me to the sleep lab. And of course, they're going to find that I have sleep apnea. They want to outfit me with a CPAP machine. But how relevant is it, you know, for patients with AFib?
Yeah. And, you know, again, obstructive sleep apnea is definitely a very prevalent finding in patients with AFib, especially the older patient population. We tend to ask almost on a routine basis, we all tend to screen, I should say, for sleep apnea symptoms. And, you know, they're easy to elucidate. And it's even easier when you have a family member, because sometimes the patients just not, they're not forthcoming. And of course, you know, when you ask a patient, do you snore at night? Say, doc, I don't know. I don't hear myself. So, you know, you have to have a partner or somebody, you know, in the house, because sometimes, you know, they snore so loudly that even if you're not in the same room with them, they can be heard across the hall. And, you know, we have, you know, of course, you know, partners tell us that they, you know, hear the apnea. So they hear the patient stop breathing. Of course, the telltale sign of sleep apnea, you know, something that we always, you know, look for is, you know, the level of energy they have during the day. You know, typically patients with sleep apnea feel fatigued most of the day. They fall asleep very easily, even sometimes when they don't want to at their job. And so once we kind of sort of identify these risk factors, we send them for a sleep study. The sleep study is fairly straightforward. You know, it's just, you know, somebody essentially measuring what your oxygen level is and how much you stop breathing, etc. The challenge is the treatment because, you know, of course, as your patient rightfully tells you, you know, you're going to outfit me with this contraption. You know, you have to have a mask on your face and, you know, be hooked up to a machine at night. This being said, I mean, that's very important because over and over and over again, we have seen a strong correlation between untreated sleep apnea and AFib, the first episode and subsequent recurrences. even if you initiate treatment, you know, obstructive sleep apnea can be an impediment to achieve the goal you want to achieve with the treatment, you know, which is to maintain normal sinus rhythm. So yes, you know, we have to screen for it. Yes, there is treatment, and hopefully, you know, with the new devices and the new masks and potentially other devices on the market, you know, we can kind of help these patients have a better sleep and not desaturate as much at night. You know, it's beyond the scope of what we're doing tonight to kind of discuss specifically what the mechanisms are behind, you know, sleep apnea or obesity or diabetes, you know, leading to these increased risk of AFib. But it's a very strong correlation over and over again, been proven to be the case.
Well, here you are, folks. I mean, we can't prevent AFib, and we can prevent AFib by kind of watching our weight, by exercising just, you know, kind of regularly, by reducing or even, you know, stopping alcohol consumption, as well as stopping smoking. We can do better controlling our diabetes and hypertension, and we can wear a CPAP and really prevent AFib and not have to undergo anything else that we need to do to keep our rhythm in control, because we live longer and we do better with a normal heartbeat. And Ibrahim, I don't know how much to thank you to really kind of increase awareness that, you know, AFib can be prevented. And sometimes it's the most powerful and the best measure, the one that probably costs the least, you know, and probably brings the best outcome. So Ibrahim Hanna, thank you very much. I mean, here he is, one of my partner at Ascension St. Vincent in Birmingham.
Thank you, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be with you. And I hope your patients and your listeners get something out of it that helps them change for the better.
Absolutely. And next time, we'll talk about patients that are stuck with AFib. They've tried everything. They're in AFib. How can we get them back in rhythm control? Because rhythm control is where we do best. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Thank you, Adam. Have a good night.
To learn more from our team of cardiologists, please visit us at myheart.net. You can also follow us on social media by searching myheart.net on Facebook and Twitter. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss our next episode.